It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. A law that drew massive protests and made Wisconsin the center of a national fight over union rights, Act 10 is still being challenged in court 13 years after it took effect.
Last week, a Dane County judge ruled that parts of the law violate the equal protection guarantees of the state constitution.
Act 10 sharply limited collective bargaining rights for most public employees, but it provided exemptions for public safety employees like police officers and firefighters.
We look at the potential effects of the recent ruling on public employees with John Shelton, a professor and chair of democracy and justice studies at UW-Green Bay. John, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Hey, thanks for having me, Kate and Rob. It's great to be here.
So Dane County Judge Jacob Frost rules that Act 10 violates the state constitution's equal protection provision. What aspects of Act 10 does the judge see as a violation here?
Yeah, so Judge Frost looked at, there's a five-part test for the sort of rational basis of whether or not the division between public safety workers and general workers was legitimate, was rational, and said that effectively it's not, because you have certain groups like Capitol Police, who you would think would be included in public safety workers, were not included. And then workers like folks for the motor vehicle department were included under the public safety category. So what the judge said is that there's no rational basis for dividing those two categories. And the decision, and this is really big, is he effectively said that all the collective bargaining aspects of Act 10 are unconstitutional. And so what he, now there's still a lot up in the air, I'm sure we're gonna get into this, but what he's, it's unclear exactly what the remedy is gonna be at this point. What he's effectively said is that he wants both the plaintiffs and the defendant's attorneys to come back and say, okay, what should be the remedy based on this situation? So we're still kind of waiting for that, but the really kind of broad reaching nature of the decision is huge, actually, because overturning all the collective bargaining aspects of Act 10 effectively means that for the vast majority of public employees, there's a real path to having meaningful collective bargaining rights in the state.
And we're going to dig deeper into what these arguments might be for what sections of Act 10 could be struck under the judge's ruling. But first, can you back up for a moment and give us a little primer here on the state constitution's equal protection clause and what it means?
Yeah. So, okay, I'm going to say this by pointing out that I'm not an attorney.
Sure.
But I'd be making a little bit more money if I did, probably. But equal protection clause effectively says that you can't treat different people differently, effectively, right? In terms of the rights that folks have under the Constitution, and so at least all things being equal. So if you're going to treat people differently and say this group of people has access to these rights and this group of people doesn't, then you have to actually have, again, what this has been used in numerous cases. There's a five-part rational basis test to say, okay, the state does have an interest in dividing people into these categories. So, for public safety workers, the argument might be, well, you know, it's important. They talked about this in oral arguments. You might need to have labor. It might be more likely to have labor peace if police and fire are able to collectively bargain, and the state might put a premium on that. So if you are going to treat people differently, you have to have some kind of reason for doing so. You can't just sort of indiscriminately say we're going to give these rights to this group of people and these rights to this other group of people, and that's what the judge argued sort of happened with Act 10.
Can you talk about the plaintiffs here and who has brought this challenge to Act 10?
Yeah, so the challenge is being brought by a series of unions, who pooled their resources and said we want to make a legal argument sort of together that will be the best legal argument. One of the unions, full disclosure, is the Teaching Assistants Association, which is a union that's affiliated with AFT Wisconsin, as well as AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees in Wisconsin. Argument again is that their members are being treated unequally by not having the same collective bargaining rights as public safety workers have in the state.
And under this ruling, a group like yours could be poised to retake some rights and privileges that you had before Act 10?
So, yes, it's important to note that, you know, the public employee unions never went away in this state, right? I mean, collective bargaining is one tool that unions use, you know, to kind of, you know, what a union basically does is it takes worker concerns, you know, worker efforts to improve their workplace and sort of puts them all in one place and allows them to, as the name would suggest, collectively advocate, collectively negotiate for better wages and working conditions. And in the public sector, it's really important because this also includes in the education world, advocating for things that are good for our students. What Act 10 did is it basically said, you can still advocate for those things. You can still push for those things. I mean, we have, you know, broad ranging First Amendment rights, even without going through the recertification process that unions that are excluded from full bargaining rights still have to go through. Mm-hmm. You can't negotiate those things into a contract. So we've continued to do that in the state. But what Act 10 did is it said you can't negotiate over a lot of different things. So like teachers can't negotiate over class sizes. Workers for state agencies can't negotiate over healthcare, right? They can't negotiate over retirement benefits. Mm-hmm. And so what this ruling could do is allow all of those workers to negotiate over the same things that police and fire can negotiate, which is the sort of full suite of working conditions. So it's basically like another tool that all public sector unions in the state, most public sector unions, I should say, would then have if this ruling ends up where it could end up.
Talking with John Shelton, professor and chair of democracy and justice studies at UW-Green Bay, about a Dane County judge's recent ruling finding parts of Act 10 violate the state constitution. Act 10, as we've been talking about, sharply limited the power of public unions in Wisconsin. John Shelton, since Act 10 became law in 2011, Wisconsin has become a right-to-work state. Employees cannot be compelled to join unions. As you talk about Act 10, how does this aspect, right to work, affect public workers?
So when you say Wisconsin became a right to work state, that law that was passed in 2015, making Wisconsin a right to work state, actually applies to private sector unions. Hmm. So this ruling would have no impact on private sector workers. They're governed by federal labor law, and states have, under federal labor law, they have the option of whether or not to effectively be what you're calling right to work, what I would call excluding fair share agreements for workers, right? That if you're going to get the benefits of a union contract, you have to contribute. In the public sector, there was a national Supreme Court decision in 2017 or 18, I think it was 18, called Janus versus AFSCME, which actually forbids union security clauses, fair share fees, allows right to work in the public sector all across the country. So that aspect, that you're right, under Act 10, those sorts of agreements were made illegal, but that's now been superseded by the U.S. National Supreme Court case. So that wouldn't change.
Okay.
As would be the case in every state in this country.
And as we broaden out here, a federal appeals court in 2014 ruled Act 10 was constitutional. And in that same year, the Wisconsin Supreme Court upheld the law. What arguments do you think would be made in an appeal that might keep Act 10 in place as is?
Yeah, so it's important to note that this is a novel challenge, right? I mean, when you again, not an attorney, but when you challenge things in the courts, you know, you have to kind of find new ground to challenge them. So those cases, and actually Judge Frost referenced this in his decision. He did say these are new grounds to challenge the case. So those decisions, while there may be some arguments that are sort of recycled there, this would be a completely new kind of set of arguments. Essentially, what's going to happen now is, again, the judge has asked both sides to come back with sort of their recommendation of here's how we should sort of navigate this. Union attorneys are likely going to argue for like the most sweeping sort of remedy that would probably, you know, have the broadest possible reach of bargaining rights for public and for all general public employees. The legislature is probably going to make a more restrictive argument, which is that, you know, maybe only a smaller classification of workers should get full collective bargaining rights, like effectively kind of try to rationalize that division between public safety and general employees. And then we'll see what Judge Frost's, you know, kind of what his ruling is moving forward about what should happen. It's important to note, though, that once he makes that ruling, that will be the law of Wisconsin. So we can expect this to be right. It'll be challenged. There's an appellate court in the state. And then it will likely go to the state Supreme Court. So it will be challenged. But until that happens, this will be the law of the land. So, you know, I see no reason why public employees couldn't start pushing for the full exercise of whatever rights, you know, Judge Frost rules are should be, you know, restored in this decision.
And John Shelton, yeah. If this case reaches the state Supreme Court, earlier this year, Liberal Justice Jana Protasiewicz was asked by the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel editorial board if she would consider recusing herself because of her participation in the protests against Act 10. And let's listen to her response.
Given the fact that I marched, given the fact that I signed the recall petition, would I recuse myself? Maybe, but I don't know for sure.
Very quickly, what effects could a recusal have on this challenge if it reaches the state's high court?
Well, here's what's interesting. The thing to remember is that this case, whatever the lower court ruling is, that will be the law of the land. So if it gets to the state Supreme Court and Judge Jana Protasiewicz were to recuse herself, a 3-3 tie would effectively maintain whatever the lower court ruling is. So, you know, if there's a really sweeping ruling and she recuses herself, it might not actually overturn, might not be enough to overturn a lower court decision.
John, thank you for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Kate. Thank you so much. This is an important topic.
John Shelton is a professor and chair of democracy and justice studies at UW Green Bay, talking with him about a Dane County judge's recent ruling that parts of Wisconsin's Act 10 law violate the state constitution.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, a new report digs into foreign ownership of agricultural land in the U.S., especially from countries designated as adversaries like China and Russia.
Based on the public records voluntarily reported to USDA, all these countries do not hold any agricultural land in Wisconsin.
That's coming up on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Political leaders in Wisconsin and around the country have raised concerns about companies from foreign countries buying U.S. farmland. That includes members of the Wisconsin legislature and U.S. Senate candidates Tammy Baldwin and Eric Hovde, who have called for various limits or transparency guidelines.
A new report digs into the issue in the Journal of the American Society of Farm Managers and Rural Appraisers. The findings, according to available data, fears of China buying up huge chunks of U.S. farmland may be overstated. And the top foreign owners of American agricultural land are Canadian.
Wendong Zhang co-wrote that report. He is an assistant professor in applied economics and policy at Cornell University's Business School. Wendong, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
It's a pleasure.
So we have this concern from some politicians over the amount of foreign-owned farmland here in the United States. You dug into the records. First of all, what kind of record-keeping is there? How closely does the federal government track when foreign entities are buying American farmland?
Yep, this is a very good question. And as you mentioned, this is an increasingly hot topic. We actually have a FITA Act of 1978, Agricultural Foreign Investment Disclosure Act. So the federal regulation doesn't ban foreign land holdings, either ownership or long-term leasing, but it does require foreign persons or companies who acquire, transfer, or hold an interest in U.S. agricultural land to report their holdings and transactions to USDA.
And so a failure to report and providing false information could result in civil penalties of up to 10% of the market values. So this is a voluntary reporting with potential penalties. And what we have is that you don't know the exact location of this land holding, but you know the company name and you know which county and the how many acres and some breakdown of the land parcel characteristics, such as whether this is cropland versus forest land versus pasture.
You dug into that data from the USDA, and the big concern is so-called adversary nations owning farmland in the United States, China in particular. So when you dug into how much land by county Chinese-backed landowners had in the United States, what did you find out?
So as an overview, U.S. Foreign persons or companies hold about 43 million acres of U.S. agricultural land as of 2022, and it's about 3.4% of all privately held agricultural land. As you mentioned, the attention is on adversary countries, China, Russia, Venezuela, Cuba, and Iran, and with increasing attention on China. China actually is not one of the dominant player in this space. Canada owns and leases. So this is about 12 million acres of U.S. land, while China's total holding across the entire United States about 350,000 acres. So just by acre, it's a big number, but it's if you're looking at the percentage, it's remember this will be less than 1% of all foreign holdings. And another thing to clarify is that this may not be outright ownership. This could also include long-term leasing as well. So if you're looking at Midwest, including Wisconsin, there's a lot more wind turbines. If you look at where I am at, in New York, there are a lot of solar panels, and this some of the investment are coming from foreign countries as well. And so those are often multi-decade leases on cropland. And so those are required to be reported to USDA as well. And we do have, because we have the record level data, not only for the whole country, but also for different states as well. So I'm also happy to share some information about Wisconsin later on as well.
Hey, let's go right there. What do we know about foreign-owned farmland in Wisconsin? Who owns it and what's happening on that land?
So the U.S. has 3.4% of all privately held agricultural land owned or long-term leased by foreign persons, or actually more foreign companies. Mm-hmm. And that percentage in Wisconsin is 2.4%. There are two interesting points when we are looking at the Wisconsin is 85% of all land that has a foreign interest is forest land. So it's not cropland, not pasture land. It's actually like a nearly about 400,000 acres of forest land, predominantly Canadian ownership. It's played a bigger role. So 85% of the land with a foreign interest is forest land. There's another interesting thing is when you're looking at the breakdown, some of the top players, some of the top companies in Wisconsin is actually doesn't have any predominant country code. And in that case, USDA actually doesn't require you to report the multiple country involved in this transactions. So if you're looking at the raw data, we can only see the country code is 999, no predominant country code, but they actually holds probably the lion's share of all the foreign land holdings of in Wisconsin. About half of the land with a foreign interest are held by these about 3 to 5 large companies with no one dominant country. So it's likely a collection of Western, Canadian and Western European countries. But this also highlights the need to beef up the quality of the reporting. So I'm sure that many politicians in Wisconsin and the public would like to know sort of the breakdown or the what are the countries involved in those, especially given their significant presence in Wisconsin.
Now, if I'm reading your charts correctly, I believe Wisconsin is included in what you call the lake region of the United States. When it comes to China, land owned by companies based in China, that's zero. There are 0 acres owned by China in this region. Am I reading that right?
Yeah, that's correct. So when you're looking at the adversary countries, so China, Russia, Iran, North Korea, and Venezuela, based on the public records voluntarily reported to USDA, all these countries do not hold any agricultural land in Wisconsin. That said, many people could say this is because this could indicate the quality of the data. It's possible maybe there are some Chinese presences underrepresented if, for example, if the Chinese entities hold some minor shares of this no predominant country code holdings, as I noted before. The bottom line is if you're concerned about significant Chinese holdings of agricultural land in Wisconsin, the evidence seems to say the contrary.
We are talking to Wendong Zhang, assistant professor in applied economics and policy at Cornell University. Talk about research he did on foreign ownership of farmland, cropland here in the United States, Wisconsin and beyond. Wendong, as a researcher, we're hearing politicians say we need to crack down on foreign ownership, or at least we need better record keeping and transparency. Speaking as a researcher, as you were doing this, were there changes that you thought, gosh, if they kept better records or enforced the collection of this data better, we would have a better data set? What kind of changes would have helped you in this research?
If multiple countries holds one piece of agricultural land, we only have one record and likely the dominant player, but we would like to know what other countries are involved and we will have a more complete picture. And second, that we're interested in the report. I think we can improve the quality of the reporting where when a company is reporting on to USDA, they need to become more transparent about their parent company. So we only know they could come up with a shell company name where it's harder to detect where the funding is coming from, especially when there's no predominant country code. I think those are some of the things that could help with our research. And USDA and the U.S. government accountability office actually issued a recent report that calls for better quality, better data reporting, and better training of USDA of the county officials at a farm service agency within that agency, because these companies are not reporting to the headquarters in DC. They're reporting to the counties, one particular county USDA official in Wisconsin and other states. And many people at the local counties lack the resources and trainings to know how to vet and ensure the quality and the completeness of the data they received.
One other concern that some politicians have raised goes like this, I think. Hey, maybe some of this land is near military installations in the United States, could possibly be grounds for espionage. Now, given the limits of the data, you tried to figure that out. This is county level data. So that may not tell us if land is right next to a military installation. But based on the available data, what were you able to figure out?
So unfortunately, the database doesn't have a specific location of the land holding. What we can do is we can only compare the land with the land in a county with military installations versus not. And we do not find a significant increase of targeting of foreign countries into these countries with higher presence of military base. But we understand and appreciate the concern, and I think that There are already state level and federal level legislations to make sure there are enough vetting during the process, especially there are sensitive military installations nearby. I think that maybe as part of the approval process, this needs to become part of the routine if you are in such a county with significant military presence.
Looking at states around the country, you just mentioned, Wendong, that a lot of states have policies in place that put some kind of limits on foreign land ownership. In your report, you say other states are looking at that. What kind of things are out there? What kind of things, what kind of restrictions have states put into place?
So there are different kind of policies, and there are policies that overall restrict all foreign land holdings. And there are states that, like Texas, that ban specific countries such as China. There are some proposals both at U.S. Congress, for example, to think about to expand the eligibility and requirements of the foreign entities to report not only land holdings with 10 years leasehold or more, but also report leaseholding less than that, like 5 to 10 years. There are also proposals thinking about potentially requiring the foreign entities holding any share, not just the majority or significant share of U.S. land, needs to report to USDA. For example, if a Chinese company and a Wisconsin company create a joint venture, and the dominant shareholder is business in Wisconsin holding 80%. Even in this case, then some of the legislative proposal requires if your business partners and significant shareholders are from a foreign countries, then you also bear the responsibility to report more details under the AFIDA Act.
I'm looking at a chart in your paper, Wendong, just showing, you know, which countries own farmland in the United States. I mean, the big story here is Canada. It's off the charts compared to everybody else. What stood out to you in terms of Canadian ownership or long-term leasing of American cropland?
Yeah, I think that there are two things to note. And in addition to what you commented on, that the Canada rather than China is a dominant player, if you're concerned about foreign land ownership, we understand that, you know, the political risk posed by Canada and China is different.
Right.
But when you're looking at the Canadian land holding, there's another significant thing is that it's a significant as of now, but half of the land holding are actually acquired and over the past 10 years. So there are significant efforts to ramp up this land holdings. And a part of that is increasing presence of at least a cropland for renewable energy investment in solar and renewable and solar and wind as well. So it's not just buying forest land as they has been doing for decades, but they are also increasingly involved in leasing cropland, often outside the Midwest, but increasingly all over the country in order to invest in renewable energy development, taking advantage of the federal and state level policy incentives too.
Wendong, you and your co-authors in the paper don't really take a political stance on the benefits and risks of foreign ownership of American agricultural land. Would you want to make a case, though, for the importance of collecting good data, the best data we can, to at least understand the scope of foreign ownership of ag land in the U.S.?
Without the accurate and complete data, then people will make up their own stories, and we don't really know the actual picture. And one example is, for example, if you want to know the Chinese presence in commercial real estate, because there's no significant reporting, we actually have no idea. We only have anecdotal stories. Regarding the impacts that my colleague Michael Taylor at Auburn University and I have done some research, and we find that the foreign companies and other foreign buyers tend to buy much larger tracts because of higher transaction costs. In addition, they seems to be paying on average higher prices than their American counterpart when they're buying farmland parcels when we are trying to compare the per acre prices. But the USDA has done some systematic work to look into whether the foreign land holdings have caused any major changes in land prices or land availability. And I want to remind the listeners that it's only 3.54% of all U.S. agricultural land, and especially in Wisconsin and other Midwestern states, that the foreign influence is actually smaller. The effects is much more modest, and they do not find any significant influence based on the current data.
Wendong, thanks again for joining us today.
Yep. It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Wendong Zhang is an assistant professor in applied economics and policy at Cornell University. You can read more about his report on foreign ownership of American farmland at WPR.org. You can follow the latest news while you're there. Share stories with friends and family and stream this network live while you're there. Again, that's all at WPR.org.
Still ahead on Wisconsin Today, the Ice Age Trail spans over 1,200 miles here in the state, and some people hike the whole thing in one shot or one piece at a time. Meet the Ice Age Trail through hikers. That's next here on WPR News.
This is Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You may have heard of thru-hiking the Appalachian Trail or the Pacific Crest Trail. Thru-hikers take everything they need in a backpack and take 5 months or longer to hike thousands of miles across the United States.
We'll talk about the once fringe hobby that's become mainstream, including here in Wisconsin, just ahead. First, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a fiber artist in Milwaukee.
The art of quilting goes back thousands of years, with different communities, families, and artists developing their own style. Heidi Parks has found her own niche in quilting by creating collages that tell stories. WPR's Margaret Faust visited Parks in her studio at the Pfister Hotel in Milwaukee, where she's the artist in residence.
I placed the quilt on a table, and the part that I want to work on is just off the edge of the table. On my index finger, I have a gripping thimble to help pull the needle through to the other side. And on my ring finger, I have a pushing thimble with a metal tip, and that helps push the needle through. And that drawing the thread through the quilt is just one of the most satisfying sounds to me in the whole world. I'm Heidi Parks. I'm a quilter in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, the current artist in residence at the Pfister Hotel, and I love improvisational hand piecing and hand quilting. I grew up in Naperville, Illinois, the western suburbs of Chicago. I have always been very creative, and I think I grew up in a family that encouraged that a lot, so it felt very natural. My grandma, she organized a collaborative quilt for me before I was born and invited all of my aunts to collaborate on it. And then she also made a block with an umbrella on it. And the way that the umbrella protects the person in the block from the rain is just such a metaphor for me of how quilts are meant to protect people. I went to art school at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago. And then I came back to Naperville, and I was a high school art teacher there for 9 years. I started to feel the squeeze of the financial situation. I could quit and become a quilter because I had started making quilts out of fabric 9 months beforehand. I like to track all the everyday things that go on as I'm working on a quilt. When I make a diary quilt, I like to think that it is a place to do the good work that happens in a diary. The inherent slowness of quilting allows me that time to process and think about things. And generally when I'm making them, I just need to know my next right move. I don't need to see the whole quilt in advance. And I think a diary is like that too. You buy one and you're full of wonder. I often like to think of my quilts as ways of casting spells or manifesting things like my arm feeling better, but also like improving my workspace. And it was pretty amazing to me that I outlined my home studio space in gold on that quilt in October. And then in November, I got a phone call from the Pfister Artists in Residence program asking if I would be interested in moving my studio to the hotel for a year. And I thought, wow, I'm not even done making this quilt yet. And it's already creating this magical opportunity for me. The materials in my quilts are very important to me. What I like more is storytelling. So if it's a particular skirt of mine that I don't wear anymore, that tells an interesting story and adds an element to the quilt that is very meaningful. It's important to me that my quilts are soft and malleable, that they, while they hang on the wall, they are full of the potential to wrap you up with comfort.
WPR's Margaret Faust brought us that audio postcard featuring Heidi Parks, who's the artist in residence at the Pfister Hotel in Milwaukee. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
This is Wisconsin Today.
Now, you may have heard of thru-hiking. Thru-hikers take everything they need in a backpack as they hike sometimes thousands of miles across the United States.
Here in Wisconsin, we have the Ice Age Trail. Last year, more than 100 people hiked the 1,200-mile trail between Door and Polk counties.
Melissa Pyrick is the Director of Marketing and Community Relations for the Ice Age Trail Alliance. Melissa, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Now, you've talked to a lot of Ice Age Trail through hikers who stop by your office, I understand, sometimes for food and a break. Why do people choose to give up as much as a few months of their lives and hike the whole trail?
You know, it depends on the through hiker. Everybody has a different objective. Sometimes you run across people who are at a transition point in their life, you know, maybe that's divorce, or a spouse has recently passed, or a lot of times it's, hey, I just retired. We did have one younger guy came through, and he said he was hiking or through hiking because, well, his lease ran out on his apartment and he was homeless, so he figured he would go and through hike. So yeah, it's always fun. It's always interesting when they do come through. We had a couple that came through. They used the Ice Age Trail to through hike as a cool down from their Continental Divide Trail through hike. So, you know, just depends on the hiker.
We talked to a few people who have hiked the trail in different ways. Want to give a listen to one. Franara Radke from Ripon completed a section hike of the Ice Age Trail in December of last year. Section hike is when someone does the whole trail, but in pieces over the course of months or even years. Here's what we heard from Franara.
I come from the ultra running community, so I have done ultra running distances up to 100 miles. But 4 years ago, I was diagnosed with breast cancer. And after my diagnosis and treatment, one of my surgeons said, well, you can't run for 6 weeks. But my doctor told me I could hike all I wanted and I could walk all I wanted. So I wore out my running shoes on the pavement. And then I started delving into the depths of the Ice Age Trail. I have a little bit of an obsessive personality. I got the big poster map and I'm like, oh, I can start highlighting this stuff. And every time I come home, I can highlight a new section. It kind of snowballed.
And Melissa, you mentioned a lot of people will set out with something like this at a turning point in their lives. For Inara, clearly an example of people who have done that. What do people after they hike the Ice Age Trail, what do you hear from them about what this meant often at a difficult point in their lives?
Yeah, I mean, people will, you know, finish the trail and have a sense of accomplishment. I know we've had a ton of people who have finished the trail segment hiking, and I hear a lot of, well, now what am I going to do?
The first through hike, I understand, was in 1979. Jim Stoddard did that. It came in fits and starts with other people since then. We keep hearing there are books and movies about people doing, you know, the Appalachian Trail, the Pacific Coast Trail. Is that getting people more interested in doing something like hiking the entire Ice Age Trail?
So when it comes to through hiking, there's sort of the three big trails in the United States: the Appalachian Trail, the Pacific Crest Trail, and then the Continental Divide Trail. And these are, you know, long trails that go through multiple states. And kind of after that, then you have the Ice Age Trail, the Arizona Trail, the Florida Trail, you know, all these other national scenic trails. And what tends to happen is that a thru hiker will start on one of the big three trails, and then they probably will finish all the three trails, but then they're still looking for another challenge. So then they start doing all of the scenic trails. And so we get a lot of people from other states that come in, and a lot of people that have hiked the Appalachian Trail, for example. And, you know, I was talking to one woman a couple seasons ago, and she thought, well, I did the Appalachian Trail, so the Ice Age Trail was going to be really easy. Well, she ended up abandoning her hike on the Ice Age Trail because she didn't like the solitude of it. You know, you have this trail, the Appalachian Trail, where you're hiking with like 50, 70, 100 other people every day. That is not the experience you will have on the Ice Age Trail if you're a thru hiker. You will go multiple days without seeing people if you are up in the northern part of the trail. So it's a completely different trail. I always like to tell people that, you know, we don't have mountains that you're gonna, you know, fall off of. Nothing too super treacherous, but we do have ticks and we do have humidity, and camping, trying to figure out where you're gonna camp is a logistical issue that you have to overcome on the trail. And you have the solitude. So the Ice Age Trail has its own challenges, which makes it pretty fun and unique, I think.
We're talking about hiking the Ice Age Trail here in Wisconsin with Melissa Pirik, Director of Marketing and Community Relations for the Ice Age Trail Alliance. Let's hear now from another hiker. Sam Maluski, originally from Watertown, is currently making his way across Wisconsin. Sam talked to us in mid-May, slack packing from Eau Claire. Here's a listen.
I think one of the biggest takeaways when you are going to be doing the Ice Age or any trail is to expect the unexpected. I started on March 20th, my first morning on the trail. It was 8 degrees out. All my water for the next day had frozen completely solid, and there was snow on my tent from the condensation of my breath. So I started that first day with no breakfast, no water, and I had to hike about 10 miles until I was able to crack open one of my water bottles with a tent stake. And I actually got my first bit of trail magic right away on day two. I had a local trail angel who messaged me on Facebook saying, hey, it's going to snow 8 inches tonight. I live pretty close. Do you want to stay at my house?
Melissa, what is a trail angel?
Oh, a trail angel is someone who will support hikers. And on the Ice Age Trail, we really have a strong community of trail angels. A lot of times trail angels will give segment hikers a ride so that, you know, you don't have to do an out and back, so you can do a complete segment. Other times, you know, trail angels will provide water to through hikers or a place to stay, like, you know, will offer their yards to, for a through hiker to camp in. The trail angels span the entire 1200 miles, and it's really great. You know, you hear of Emily Ford, who through hiked the trail. She was the first woman to through hike the trail during the winter. I think that was in 2021. There were famously people who went out in advance of where she was going to be hiking to break the trail for her, to make it easier to hike during the winter. Yeah, the trail angels are great. And in fact, last year I was talking to a through hiker who has hiked the three major trails. And she said, what makes the Ice Age Trail unique is the ownership that the people take of it. She said, whether you encounter someone who's maintained the trail, you know, they'll refer to it as, oh, that's the section, you know, I maintain, or this is my favorite segment, or, oh, I'm the trail angel for this area. And she said, you don't find that on other trails, that we take so much ownership of this trail. And I thought that was really great, and a real testament to, you know, just the residents of Wisconsin. We love this trail and we really support the people who hike it.
Another important part, I understand, of through hiking culture is people take on trail names. We talked to Melanie Radzicki McManus, who set a record, by the way, for the fastest known time, the first time she through hiked the Ice Age Trail in 2013, did it again in 2015 to write a book about it. Melanie got her first trail name, Valderie, on the Ice Age Trail. She tells us that didn't last very long.
When I went on my second trail, the Florida Trail, they all had really easy names like Scout and Boxcar and Beer Man, and no one could remember my name or pronounce it, so I changed it to Snowshoe, and that's what I've been using ever since.
Can you tell us a little bit about that culture of trail names?
Yeah, you know, again, I am not a through hiker, so I do not have a trail name.
Oh, okay.
And it's funny when those the through hikers come through and they refer to themselves by their trail name. You know, apple pie. But I, since I'm not a through hiker, I feel funny referring to them as their trail name. But from what I understand, a trail name is something you acquire when you're on trail from another hiker usually. So apple pie, her real name is Arlette, and she really likes desserts. And she's also from the Netherlands. So apple pie is her name. Then there was a guy that holds the current FKT right now. His trail name is Wild Turkey, and it relates to some story on the trail of him, you know, doing shots of wild turkey. So
I thought, you know, maybe he was encountering a wild turkey. Okay, I get it.
Right. It's always funny to find out the story behind their trail name.
Melissa, thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you.
Melissa Pirek is Director of Marketing and Community Relations for the Ice Age Trail Alliance. Wisconsin has 41 delegates who will be in Milwaukee at the Republican National Convention next week.
As we fan out and talk with delegates at Pfizer Forum, what do you want to know from them? What are you watching for from the RNC? Are there particular speeches or aspects of the party platform that you're paying more attention to, and why?
Tell us about your perspective on the RNC and the November election. You can call in right now, leave us a message, or text us. Either way, the number is 888-642-0232. That's 888-642-0232. You can also email wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
And thank you so much for contributing your thoughts as we put together news coverage and we track developments at this summer's party conventions.
Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.